Hello, and welcome to McLean's on the Hill. I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio.
And I'm Aaron Wary, Associate Editor for McLean's Magazine.
9 current and former senators have had their expense cases sent to the RCMP. The upcoming Auditor General's report is also expected to flag 21 senators for improper claims, including the 3 most powerful members of the upper chamber. We speak with the leader of the opposition in the Senate, James Cowan, and after that, the McLean's panel weighs in.
The police report into the October 22nd Parliament Hill shooting has been released, and it finds the RCMP had the chance to stop Michael Zahafbibo before he reached center block, but didn't. A former RCMP deputy commissioner is here to walk us through what went wrong and why there were so many security gaps.
The Truth and Reconciliation Commission released its final report this week after 6 years of investigating Canada's residential school system. There are 94 recommendations, but one main focus is education. And on that issue, we hear from former Prime Minister Paul Martin.
Employment Minister Pierre Poilievre has recently been attacking the opposition over child benefits, taxes, and pensions. McLean's Ottawa Bureau Chief John Geddes goes one-on-one with Poilievre to cut through the spin.
For your politics, for your power, welcome to The Hill. Just days before the release of the Auditor General's report into all senators' expenses, the cases of 9 current and former senators have been referred to the RCMP. In all, Auditor General Michael Ferguson's report identifies $976,000 in questionable expense claims among 30 senators. 5 of those senators alone account for more than $500,000.
2 sitting senators are among the group of 9, and Senator Pierre-Hugues Boisvenu has already resigned from the Conservative caucus. The other is reportedly Liberal Colin Kenney. The audit, which reportedly cost nearly $21 million to conduct, reviewed more than 80,000 transactions worth about $180 million. Also flagged by the AG for improper claims are the 3 most powerful members in the upper chamber, Speaker Leo Houssakis, the Leader of the Government in the Senate, Claude Carignan, and the Leader of the Opposition, James Cowan. These 3 are the very same leaders who recently brought in a new arbitration process to give senators a chance to appeal the findings of the audit, a luxury never provided to Mike Duffy, Pamela Wallin, Patrick Brazzo, or Mac Harb. The full audit will be made public on Tuesday.
Now, I was able to speak with Claude Carignan about his expenses on Thursday when I caught up with him in the foyer of the Senate.
Have you been flagged in this Auditor General's report, and what are the circumstances surrounding that?
Yes, the circumstances, it's about the travel from one of my employees, staffer. So he did a mistake, he misunderstood the rules, and he have 10 or 12 trips that he made this mistake, and he already reimbursed the amount. It's around $3,000.
McLean's Ottawa Bureau Chief John Geddes connected by phone with the Leader of the Opposition in the Senate, James Cowan, who begins by laying out the issues with his expenses.
I know I've done absolutely nothing wrong. When I travel on private business, I pay for it myself. When I travel on parliamentary business, I appropriately charge it to the Senate, and that's what I did in these cases. All the claims are all properly documented, supported by receipts and invoices and hotel bills and everything else. They were received, they were submitted on the appropriate Senate forms 4 years ago. They were reviewed by the Senate people in the Senate administration who do that, and no questions were raised, no additional information or documentation was required. They were processed, they were paid. And now, 4 years later, the Auditor General thinks there should be some more information, some more explanation. And I have what was submitted then in support of my claims, and I have nothing more. I have no more information, no more documentation, no more explanation.
Is the point of dispute that he doesn't feel you can fully support your claim about what the travel was for?
I think that's it. I've asked him specifically, you know, what is it? What should I have submitted then? Or what should I have retained until now? And I got no answer.
Okay.
So I don't know that there's anything specific that he's looking for. It's just, I guess he feels that it isn't enough. But, you know, at the time I came back from my trip, I concluded that this was a legitimate Senate business and filed a claim accordingly. Had I been asked at that time to provide more information, I probably could have. But it's 4 years ago, and, you know, I do travel a fair amount, and certainly have a number of trips in the course of a year to Toronto, and to remember what happened on one rather than another is just beyond my I don't I just simply do not have the information.
Senator, you're using the singular trip. Is it literally one trip?
There are three trips.
Three trips. Are they related in some way, or are they disconnected?
They're separate trips.
Separate trips. Okay. Well, we'll watch for the details on that. The second point that people have wondered about is why you and other senators who had received letters from the AG suggesting that your expenses were in question, why you were involved in the process of setting up the appeal to the panel, I guess it is, that Justice Binney is going to head. Why were you involved in that when your own case was in question?
Well, let me clarify. First of all, it's a sole arbitrator.
Right. There's no panel. I apologize. Yeah.
He's acting himself. We've been talking about this since, you remember, a few years ago with the Duffy Wallen and Brazeau case, and where there was no process in place at all, and the Senate was, you know, judging initially the government was trying to protect their three senators, and then they did a 180 and they wanted to throw them under the bus. And I, amongst others, was arguing, look, this is wrong. We're a legislative chamber. We're not a court. We shouldn't be doing this. We shouldn't be judging our own. This is not right. And we should have a process in place. And the government pushed through what they did. And I felt then, and I think everybody feels since, that whatever we did then, whether it was, you know, justified or not, was the wrong way to do it, and that we needed to develop a better process, because inevitably in the future there would be disputes between Senate and senators and Senate administration over expenses. And the idea that it would be senators reviewing senators' expenses just wasn't on. So we had talked about the concept of having some sort of dispute resolution process, an independent arbitrator, for some time, going back to the days of Senator Kinsella, and then through Senator Nolan, and now with Speaker Housakos, and we evolved this. A proposal was made to Internal Economy a few months ago. The process was approved by Internal Economy. I wasn't at that meeting, so I can't tell you what discussion took place, but it was, and then you'll recall it, somebody helpfully leaked it to the press. And then when Justice Binney was appointed, I suggested that he should have a look at the document, have some input into the final document, and that was done, and he made some very helpful suggestions which improved the process, made it fairer, and that's the process we have. So I think that Canadians should look at it and say, well, this is not, we're not, it's not the old days when senators were approving each other's expenses. This is a highly respected, thoroughly independent person who's going to be arbitrating these things. And I think that that's a good thing. I think it's a process we should have had in place a few years ago, and we didn't. But the fact we didn't then doesn't mean we shouldn't have it now.
Given that you've got the process now, do you feel that the, I understand there are 9 senators who have more serious expense questions hanging over them, do you feel they should have access to the Binney resolution, you know, dispute resolution process, or are they in a separate category from you and the other senators who have a lower level of concern around your expenses?
It's my understanding that they will be offered the opportunity to participate in the Binney process. Mm.
Do you think that's right? I mean, it seems a bit awkward that the RCMP might be looking into people at the same time that the former judge is examining what's happened with them.
Well, that's a question. I think that in that case, you know, you'd have to make it an evaluation about whether you'd want to submit yourself to that process or not. That's a choice I don't have to make, but it is a choice that others will make, and I, you know, it's just an option that's available.
Senator,
I think it's fair to provide that option to everybody.
Right. Do you think it should then have been available even to Duffy, Harb, Brazeau, and Wallen?
Well, I argued at the time that we needed to have some sort of independent set of eyes looking at these things. It just wasn't good enough that we were judging our own. We're not a court of law. We're a legislative chamber. Everybody thinks that this is a good process, and I haven't heard a single person question the appointment of Justice Binney.
Right. I wouldn't question his appointment. I wonder a little bit about what kind of resources he's going to have, given the fact that the Auditor General has a large staff that can do a lot of combing through documents and looking at circumstances with some expertise. I wonder how it is that the Binney appeal would seem more authoritative than the Auditor General's review.
Well, I think that he will, you know, he'll have whatever resort. I don't know what the budget is. I don't know what the terms of engagement was. I was not involved.
Right.
So I don't know, but he will obviously be provided with whatever resources he needs to do the job in the way that he needs to do it.
Senator, since the Senate Liberals were severed off from the House of Commons Liberals by Justin Trudeau, you've made a lot of efforts to try to sort of rejuvenate the process. Do you feel discouraged now that this new process is basically, I don't know, if it hasn't dealt a body blow to that, is at least it's got to be a setback?
Well, it certainly is a setback. You know, none of us would want to be in this situation. The Senate doesn't want to be in this situation, but we are where we are, and we have to deal with the reality. We have to deal respectfully with and seriously with the report.
That was McLean's Auto Bureau Chief John Geddes speaking with the leader of the opposition in the Senate, Liberal James Cowan.
Well, it's now time for the McLean's panel, and I'm joined by my co-host, Associate Editor for McLean's, Aaron Wary, and the McLean's Political Editor, Paul Wells. Thanks very much for being here.
Hi.
Okay, so we have all these latest developments coming out of the Senate, more and more senators being named as having improper expenses, three of them being the top three senators in the upper chamber, the Speaker, the Leader of the Government, and the Leader of the Opposition. Paul, how much of a mess is this right now?
Well, if it ain't a mess, it'll do till the mess gets here. A few points. There is no one so senior in the Senate that they seem to have not gotten into trouble on their expenses. It goes to the top ranks of the upper house. And this is a little bit of a help to the prime minister and the government, because most of these senators who are in the worst trouble were Liberal appointees. And so the conservatives can say, well, it wasn't just us. As a matter of fact, it wasn't even mostly us. It was also the other guys. And beyond that, it probably helps the New Democrats. There are no NDP senators, and so therefore there are no crooked NDP senators, and that's probably a handy thing. Finally, I think it helps Mike Duffy and Pam Wallin, who have both been saying all along that to the extent they broke the rules or bent the rules or were not made aware of the rules, they had plenty of company, and company has finally arrived.
Is Trudeau sort of buffered in a way that he separated his caucus from the Liberal Senate caucus? Does that help him in any way?
He at least doesn't have to answer any questions about kicking anybody out of caucus. He doesn't have to make any announcements about people getting kicked out of caucus. There is now that space. He also didn't appoint any of these people. And his Senate reform proposal, such as it is, that he would set, if he was prime minister, he would set up an independent commission to suggest appointees, also suddenly starts to look like a reasonable option. The conservatives don't want to appoint senators, it seems, anymore. And I think that's a big question for them going forward in terms of whoever is the next leader of the party. The NDP wants to abolish the Senate, but that would require negotiating with the provinces and constitutional talks. And so suddenly Justin Trudeau has maybe the only relatively painless proposal for Senate reform. Now, granted, I am interested to see whether this leads to a big push for abolition, whether provinces start coming out and wanting to get ahead of that. I agree with Paul, though, that the NDP now gets, by virtue of the fact that they've never held power, they now get to sort of point and laugh.
Okay, let's talk about the process moving forward, because it seems kind of messy. We have this appeal process that was created by the three top senators who do have questionable expenses. The optics are very bad that they have questionable claims. They've set up this appeal process. There could be an RCMP investigation as well. You could have parallel investigations going on from two different entities.
Yeah, I think probably everyone realized that when it went to the Auditor General, we were heading into years and not months of grief, and I think that's only beginning. I think to some extent Mike Duffy's defense in trial right now is every senator's defense, and much will ride on the outcome of the Duffy trial. I mean, because basically the Duffy defense is the rules were not clear enough. I mean, if Duffy were to be acquitted, then that I expect every lawyer in town would be quoting those same lines in various legal proceedings.
And Aaron, you've been looking into another Senate issue, not just this, but the fact that there are many vacancies, and I believe somebody's challenging the government in court on this. So what have you been looking into?
Well, yeah, these vacancies have been piling up, and there is a court case now being where a lawyer is challenging the idea that the prime minister doesn't have to appoint senators, or that the prime minister has an obligation to be filling these vacancies on a regular basis. And now, you know, with the two current senators facing serious allegations that are apparently going to be forwarded to the RCMP, maybe those are two other either suspensions or resignations. The chamber starts to look pretty empty after a while. And again, that comes back to, well, how the heck are we going to fill these spots? Do we have to fill these spots? You know, we face the prospect of basically an increasingly empty Senate. And then across town, a rolling cascade of years and years of trials of senators on their expenses.
All right, thanks very much. That's McLean's associate editor, Aaron Wary, and McLean's political editor, Paul Wells. And I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio.
Still to come on the show, we speak with a former high-ranking Mountie about how the RCMP failed to stop Michael Halfby-Beau on October 22nd. We speak to a former Prime Minister about Aboriginal education. And Employment Minister Pierre Poilievre is challenged over his comments on pensions, taxes, and child benefits.
Welcome back to McLean's on the Hill. I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio.
And I'm Aaron Wary, Associate Editor for McLean's Magazine.
Coming up on the show, Employment Minister Pierre Poilievre goes head-to-head with McLean's Ottawa Bureau Chief John Geddes over pensions, taxes, and child benefits. And following the Truth and Reconciliation Report, we'll speak about Aboriginal education with former Prime Minister Paul Martin. But first...
On Wednesday, the police report into the Parliament Hill shooting on October 22nd was finally released. It reveals that Corporal Nathan Cirillo was shot three times in the back, not twice, as previously believed. It also lays out in detail what happened to Michael Halfby-Beau when he stormed the hill and was shot near the doors to the Library of Parliament. He spent less than 2 minutes inside center block and was first shot 7 seconds after entering. Security and police fired 56 shots, 31 of which hit Halfby-Beau. The gunman fired 3 shots in total inside center block. One of those was in his last stand near the Library of Parliament. That's when an RCMP officer and the Sergeant-at-Arms Kevin Vickers unleashed a hail of bullets. The official cause of death was multiple gunshot wounds, but there were specifically 2 fatal shots. One which pierced the heart and another from the Mountie that entered the brain. Despite conflicting reports, the review by the Ontario Provincial Police doesn't actually determine who killed Michael Halfby-Beau.
But the big story out of the report is the stinging review of security on the hill during the attack, specifically from the RCMP officers outside. It states the attack was a grim reminder that Canada is ill-prepared to prevent and respond to terrorist attacks. It also states that fortunately, the attacker was unorganized, because there could have been many more casualties. To walk us through the major security gaps and to examine how to fix them, I was able to speak with former RCMP Deputy Commissioner P.Y. Bourdois. We'll start off just by looking at the report, and I'll read straight from the report. Elements of the RCMP security force were in position to interdict the armed gunman prior to entering the Parliament building, but did not. And I want to walk through with you the reasons for that and how they can be improved. And I guess we should start with the moment that he actually walked onto the hill at around 9:52 in the morning. He drove his car up to the East Gate entrance and ran through carrying a gun. There were RCMP on Lower Drive right by those gates, not too far from there. And correct. Another officer further up, closer to the Senate side of Center Block, and yet nobody noticed him. How could that have happened?
Well, according to the report, there were actually 2 vehicles that were positioned near the entrance where Halfby-Beau actually ran onto the Parliament Hill ground. The first vehicle, according to the report, the member was reading a briefing report, because that very morning on October 22nd at 10 o'clock there was a manifestation that was scheduled for 10 o'clock. So he was reading the briefing report prior to the protest, so had his head down reading that report while sitting in the car, and the other members was parked behind this particular vehicle. So therefore, the first vehicle blocked the second member's view of the entrance on the east side of the Parliament precinct.
I think to most Canadians, it's shocking that you have so many RCMP on the hill, and yet this guy was able to run up and hijack a car without the knowledge of any of those RCMP officers.
What's interesting in the report, Cormac, if I may add, is the report clearly highlighted at one point that there was another RCMP officer that was also positioned in a car about 30 meters from where the limousine was actually hijacked. She was approached by this woman with a stroller and a baby, and this woman was pretty agitated from what the report stated and wanted to get in the back seat of the car. So our member didn't actually see initially Ziav Bibo approaching the limo because he was dealing with this woman who was in a panic and very agitated because she had heard the gunshots that happened moments before. So she was actually dealing with this lady that was trying to get into the back of the police car. And that's all of a sudden when the member who was dealing with this lady noticed Ziav Bibo approaching and that literally commandeered the limo, radioed what she had just seen while dealing with this lady. And according to the report, the whole thing happened within 27 seconds. So by then, Ziav Bibo was speeding towards the hill.
But that RCMP officer, should she have been able to block or ram the limo that Zahaf Bibo had just hijacked?
Again, it's absolutely correct, and the report highlights the fact that there was a missed opportunity for this particular member to position the car to stop the limousine from reaching the top of the hill, and for Ziav Bibo to access the center block.
Even when she got into her car and started to drive, and I know the door was open while she was driving behind Zahaf Bibo, it seemed like a very slow chase. According to the security footage that was released earlier by the RCMP, she didn't drive that fast behind him. It almost seems like, I know RCMP officers are trained in trying to disable a vehicle if they're in a chase scenario. Did she do what needed to be done in that situation to try and disable that vehicle?
Cormac, you're right. She could have, and she should have, maybe. But she was a member actually in position to make all of these judgment calls, and of course she could have. But they reached the door, and what's also quite interesting is the fact that when the members actually reach the door at center block, the report highlights the fact that they stopped.
And that boggled my mind as well. Why would the officers, knowing very well that there are politicians inside the building and a gunman just ran inside and fired a shot, they didn't enter the building right away? Why did they hold off on that?
That's another point that I had to manage, actually, in my days as deputy commissioner, whereas parliamentarians always push back about the sanctuary of parliament. So basically, members of the RCMP are responsible at the time for the ground surrounding parliament, and I've always been instructed to never enter Parliament building carrying their arms. It took a supervisor that got there seconds later to tell the guys to just move in, which they did, and they then put themselves in position to terminate the threat to Parliament.
But, I mean, common sense would dictate that somebody in that scenario, if I was an officer running up to the hill and I saw what was going on, my last thought would be about the jurisdiction rules. I would say, screw the rules. People's lives are in danger, and I have to stop this man.
I agree with you wholeheartedly with that assessment. But I'm not privy to the instructions that were given prior to this incident to the members, but I can safely say that 6 years ago, that was drilled in the mind of members working around Parliament that never to enter the Parliament building.
So we've addressed now the obvious security gaps of what happened. Let's talk about the reasoning behind it. And one thing that was lacking, actually, out of all of this was training. It found that there was inadequate training, according to the OPP report. Why weren't RCMP officers working on Parliament Hill receiving additional training to deal with the unique threats that Parliament could face?
Members of the RCMP have mandatory training where they need to qualify periodically on the efficient use of firearms. They also need to physically qualify with regards to their physical ability, of the job. And the The OPP report clearly highlighted the need to have integrated scenario-based training for members around the Hill. And apparently that was not the case because there were no mandated training. What you have to bear in mind is the root cause of all of this, because ideally in these types of situations, you'd like to have scenario-based training, which would involve all the different agencies that are responsible for the security of the Parliament precinct. And that was obviously not the case.
Why wouldn't the RCMP have tried to get this? Was it jurisdiction issues again?
Well, there's an issue here, and it was also highlighted in that report, is the silos that, for instance, House Security and the Senate Protective Services were two separate entities that were working separately. There were silos there with the RCMP as well, so each and every of these agencies were operating separately.
Resources were identified in the OPP report as being a serious problem. Specifically, the budget cuts from 2012 from the federal government are identified. Give our listeners, an idea of how difficult it is to staff the Hill and have the resources necessary to make sure that it's secure when you're facing budget cuts.
The report clearly talks about the need to have appropriate budget allocation. And one of the consequences of this particular budget cut of 2012 is that the RCMP's budget was substantially cut back. So the RCMP had to be a little more creative in relation to staffing of some of these key positions around the Hill. So they turned to reservists. So basically reservists for the RCMPs are members that have retired, but are welcome back with the organization as a reservist. They need to meet certain criteria. They need to meet the basic requirements with regards to physical fitness, with regards to ability with firearms, and so on and so forth. But once they're hired by the RCMP, they are deployed on the Hill as reservists. So they're not full-fledged members, but members that have retired and that came back. So that was one of the consequences of these budget cuts.
You have all these reports that have been submitted to the House of Commons over years about how to improve security. Many of the ones in this OPP report were already mentioned in those, and they were never put in place, even after security incidents. How confident are you that these recommendations from the OPP will actually be put in place?
Well, Cormac, I'll be brutally honest with you. Parliamentarians, by and large, view the sanctity of the Parliament as sacred, sacred, sacred. Like they don't, and some of them even complain, you know, that they're being stopped and questioned by RCMP out there, you know, with regards to their access to Parliament. And they've always kind of pushed back in relation to too much security, because they, again, and they're absolutely right in their thought with regards to strike the right balance between accessibility for Canadians and for elected officials to their Parliament, and balance it off with the appropriate level of security. So incidents that you've highlighted were of course serious ones, but they've always pushed back until October 22nd, when shots are fired within, under our common roof, which is a Parliament building. So that was, in my opinion, a wake-up call for elected officials. I am cautiously optimistic that that most of these 66 recommendations would be adopted. Assistant Commissioner Michaud indicated that actually one-third of these recommendations have already been implemented. And if you've been on the Hill recently, it's quite visible that there's a lot more of visible police presence on the Hill.
That was former RCMP Deputy Commissioner P.Y. Bourdois speaking about the security failures during the October 22nd terror attack on Parliament Hill.
Still to come, Employment Minister Pierre Poilievre goes up against McLean's Auto Bureau Chief John Geddes on pensions and child benefits, and we speak with former Prime Minister Paul Martin about First Nations education.
Welcome back to McLean's on the Hill. I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio.
And I'm Aaron Wary, Associate Editor for McLean's Magazine. Pierre Polyev has long been among the most combative conservatives in the House of Commons. But since Prime Minister Stephen Harper made him Employment and Social Development Minister this past winter, Polyev has emerged as a top cabinet voice on economic policy files, including parental benefits, taxes, and pensions, which are expected to play big in the coming federal election. McLean's Auto Bureau Chief John Geddes spoke with Pierre Polyev this week in his Parliament Hill office.
I want to ask about benefits paid to parents. So right now, as I understand it, the government spends about $18 billion a year on a raft of payments that parents get, including the National Child Benefit Supplement and what would kind of be this government's signature program, the Universal Child Care Benefit. And if I understand it correctly, what the Liberals propose to do is merge all those programs into one and then pump another $4 billion into them. And the $4 billion allows them to give every parent who's making less than $150,000 more than they get now. As a taxpayer, it seems to me that I might wonder, can we really afford that? But as a parent, why would I not just say, more money for me, that sounds good?
Well, I don't accept the premise that it is more money. The Liberal plan starts by canceling the universal child care benefit, the child tax benefit, and other benefits that direct dollars to parents, and then they claim they're going to replace it with something else. They start off by admitting that they have a $2 billion hole, that the costs of their plan are $2 billion more than they concede. Economists who have taken a more precise look at their overall plan say that it's actually bigger than $2 billion, that their tax and proposed tax increases don't raise the money that they claim, and that their calculation of the savings they would achieve by canceling the universal child care benefit are wildly optimistic. It just doesn't add up. In reality, Justin Trudeau can't find billions of dollars out of thin air that don't exist. If he starts by canceling all these benefits, and then his plan runs out of money, ultimately somebody's going to lose something that he's not telling them about right now.
You've said in the House, and other people in the government have said, you actually said, I think on, like it was March 25th, I was looking it up, that both the NDP and the Liberals have promised to eliminate pension income splitting. But in fact, they promised not to do that, right? So why would you say they're promising to do something that they explicitly say they will not do?
So the Liberals, when Stéphane Dion was leader, explicitly stated that they opposed pension splitting for seniors. They've now announced their intention to scrap income splitting for families. If you're ideologically opposed to income splitting for families, why wouldn't you scrap it for seniors?
You make a case for suspecting that they may not have their be dedicated to that program, or they may not truly believe in it. But isn't there a big leap between saying, I don't see that they're really behind this program, and saying they have promised to get rid of it? They haven't promised to get rid of it, Minister. Come on. I don't think you can point to a quote where someone in the NDP or Liberals has said, I promise to get rid of pension income
splitting. Well, they have consistently said they'll get rid of income splitting. Many times they've said so without specifying that they're talking exclusively about people with kids.
Okay.
It is perfectly reasonable to assume they're talking about everybody, and why wouldn't they be? I mean, what would be the public policy rationale
the belief that that pensioners deserve to be able to do that because they are in a particular situation or something like that.
Okay.
But there's a difference between saying I don't see the consistency in their logic and saying they have promised to do something they haven't promised to do.
Well, they have promised to get rid of income splitting. Oftentimes, they've said so without specifying for whom.
Okay. Can I ask about something else? The universal child care benefit was substantially enhanced in the last budget. But, correct me if I'm wrong here, I think you said an average of $500 will come in July as a lump sum retroactive payment of those benefits into the pockets of Canadian families. Do you not think, given that we're in the very short months before a federal election campaign, October 19th set date, that people would be justified, voters would be justified in being suspicious about the timing of a lump sum payment from the federal government landing in their bank account in that so shortly before election. Doesn't that look like basically very convenient timing for paying a lot of Canadian voters a bunch of money that they weren't maybe expecting?
So the payment on July 20th will be $520 for every child under six, and $420 for children 6 through 17.
Right. That's a lot of money. Like, for a lot of people, that's going to be a very welcome summer bonus.
I think so, and I think that the retailers start running their back-to-school ads almost at that time, so it could be very good timing for families.
And good time for you with the election coming up.
I hadn't thought of that.
You really not? Because, you know, normally I try not to be too cynical when I look at this. But it's hard not to be cynical when you think, well, man, like retroactive. Normally these kind of programs don't have a retroactivity clause in them. And to think we're going to retroactively do that and make sure people get the money just before the campaign, it just seems very, it seems cynical, frankly.
Well, we indicated that when we balanced the government's budget, we could help families balance theirs. We are now in the balanced budget era again. We indicated that this benefit would take effect starting at the beginning of 2015.
Right.
There is some logistical challenges in getting these increases up and running, and so that's why the first 6 or 7 months worth of payments all come at once, but you know, you make a point. I think that it will remind Canadians as to what is at stake in the election.
So Justin Trudeau comes out with his package, and one element of it is a new tax bracket for Canadians making more than 200 grand, at the top 5% roughly of tax or income earners in the country. To me, it seems like if the Democrats in the U.S. proposed something like this, Republicans would immediately protest that it was a tax on people who invest and create jobs. But I don't think I've heard that particular argument. In fact, I think I haven't heard very much at all from conservatives in Canada saying there's anything wrong with that proposal to hike taxes on the richest Canadians that Mr. Trudeau has made a sort of benchmark pillar of his policy. Why is that? Are you okay with an increase in taxes on those richest Canadians, or is it just that you see it as not advantageous to attack on that front? What's the situation?
My view is that Justin Trudeau will raise taxes on everyone.
Really? Because he has said he wouldn't, right?
But he just last week said that he embraced Kathleen Wynne's pension plan, which is a payroll tax increase on every single Canadian.
That's the pension and the supplementary, the new Ontario pension that's being worked out. But sir, just to get back to raising taxes on the richest people, do you think that's a bad thing, a good thing? Are you neutral on it? What do you think?
Well, we believe in lowering taxes for everyone, and that those tax reductions should be targeted at people with middle and modest incomes.
That was John Geddes speaking with Employment and Social Development Minister Pierre Poilievre.
And we'll stick with John Geddes for the moment, because he's been doing a lot of work on Aboriginal education. And this week, the Truth and Reconciliation Commission issued its landmark report into residential schools for Indigenous people. Now, the report contained 94 recommendations covering a wide range of topics. 17 of them have to do with improving education for Aboriginal kids. The situation is dire. About 60% of on-reserve students drop out of high school, compared to 10% of non-Aboriginal Canadian teenagers. Now, in Maclean's, John Geddes recently reported on one promising effort to find solutions. So, John, can you tell us what you wrote about?
Yeah, sure. Thanks, Cormac. I was taking a look at a project launched a few years ago by the Martin Aboriginal Education Initiative. That's the foundation established by former Prime Minister Paul Martin when he left politics. So what the Martin Initiative did was they funded 4 years of model schools projects on two small reserves in southwestern Ontario. I visited them. They're Walpole Island and Kettle Point, both pretty places. One is on Walpole Island's on the mouth of St. Clair River, and Kettle Point is on the shore of Lake Huron. They're both Ojibwe communities. And so with Martin's funding, it was about $1 million for each of these schools. They systematically upgraded the teaching standard for reading and writing from kindergarten to grade 8. The outcomes they had there were just unbelievable. Scores on standardized tests in reading and writing climbed from way behind, far behind the Ontario average, to nearly as good as the rest of the province in just 4 years, and actually better than the province in a couple of categories. I went to those schools, and the atmosphere there was just inspiring. But, you know, to understand what happened there, you almost have to step back and think about the starting point, the problem. How bad are on-reserve schools and why? Here's Paul Martin himself talking about that in a phone interview.
There are obviously a number of reasons why the results, the graduation results, let's say, from high school, are so much worse on reserve than they are in the public school system. So where you've got a, you know, you have a 40% graduation rate from the schools on reserve, and in the public schools, with dealing with everyone, you know, the graduation rate is in the 90s. And it, in terms of the future of what is the youngest and the fastest growing segment of our population, that is to say, Indigenous Canadians, that is a, you know, that is a real warning sign as to trouble ahead. First of all, it's immoral. But it's also economically dumb to have that. And look, there are a number of reasons, obviously beginning with the residential schools, but the fundamental reason today, the most, is the discriminatory lack of funding by the federal government to schools within its jurisdiction. Those are the on-reserve schools and the schools off-reserve. And I mean that, and you can, if you listen to the provinces and to the First Nations, that funding is anywhere from, depending upon the province, at a minimum of 30% to up to 50% per capita. And what does that mean? That means you don't have decent teachers. You can have decent teachers, but you have a phenomenal turnaround because they leave as soon as there's an opportunity to get a decent paying job somewhere else. It means you don't have programs for kids with special disabilities. It means that you don't have, you know, decent science labs. In other words, a lot of these schools are schools to which non-Indigenous Canadians would not send their children, and that is morally and economically wrong.
So that's Paul Martin laying out the problem, Cormac. A grim history, persistent underfunding, perennially poor results. Nobody pretends to have a magic bullet to change all that. But from what I saw down at Kettle Point and Walpole Island, those schools have shown how on-reserve education can make really rapid improvements with enough money and some expert teaching.
And so our listeners can find your story on Macleans.ca, right?
Yeah, that's right. And I really think that anyone who's wondering after the Truth and Reconciliation Process reports about what they can feel good about, where is the cause for optimism, you're going to find promising ideas about Aboriginal education in this project. So, you know, that's what I was trying to highlight.
Excellent. Thanks, John. Appreciate it.
Okay, good to be here.
That's it for this week's episode. Remember to check out the Macleans Pop Culture Podcast, The Thrill, and our podcast about books, Bibliopod.
But for more of your politics and power, join us next week on The Hill.